Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 115 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, and we appreciate their support. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. You are indeed appreciated. Today is Tuesday, February 12, 2008. So if you're listening on a Tuesday evening, that is February 12, 2008, shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to phone in and talk with myself and to the guest who I'll be introducing in just a minute or two. You'll find the show site at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there are links there to all of the guests, as well as to the guests' audio archives from previous shows, in case you've missed one and would like to have a listen. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active as I speak, and honestly, if you're not participating in the chat room and listening to this network, and you have a computer in front of you, which you very likely do if you're listening live, you are missing an aspect of the program that is really very useful, entertaining. All sorts of links are posted in the chat room to topics that come up in the standard banter, which is always side-splitting, and some of the smartest people on the planet are in the Head On Radio Network chat room, and we are pleased to have them there. In addition to the audio archives from the past shows, you're going to find links to the Head On Radio Network main site. That's strictlyconfidentialradio.com. The Head On Radio Network main site is where you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, and the other programs are scheduled 24 hours a day. You'll find links there for the audio, and you'll find links there for the Saturday programming. You'll find all sorts of useful information at headonradionetwork.com. That's headonradionetwork.com. You'll find there also the links to the PayPal button so that you can help support the Head On Radio Network. We are indeed listener-supported, and your contributions help keep the packets passing and the streamers streaming and the CDs spinning and the cassettes rolling along happily inside their little plastic shells. You'll find links there also to Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and you'll find links there to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. The toll-free line for participating is 877, the number 4, Head On. That's 877-443-2366. If you do have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck, and you'll be helping listener-supported radio. That's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia, but we're certainly willing to pick up the freight if you would rather use the toll-free line, which again is 877, the number 4, Head On. My email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. It is a Tuesday night. Apparently, it is the second Tuesday of the month, because just as I was starting the show, Microsoft updates started flowing in, which is always a joy, because you never know what Microsoft updates are going to do. It's a little disconcerting when they pop up in the middle of your just beginning the show. I am delighted to tell you about our guest this evening, who will be joining us shortly. His name is Andrew J. Weaver. That's Reverend Andrew Weaver. He is a PhD, and he is a United Methodist Church pastor and a research psychologist who is living in New York City. He's a graduate of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University. He's co-authored 14 books, including Counseling on Addictions and Compulsions, Reflections on Grief and the Spiritual Journey, and Connected Spirits, friends and spiritual journeys. Dr. Weaver is as appalled as many of the rest of us are at the prospect of the George Bush Presidential Library, along with a partisan think tank, being located at Southern Methodist University. Dr. Weaver is the person who's behind the petition to see if we can get this stopped. He's also the go-to man for information about it. Those of you who listen to this show regularly know that this is a constant rant that I am concerned about, having grown up in the Methodist Church, what's going on with the George W. Bush Presidential Library. There is a quote from George Bush: "I'm going to build a fantastic Freedom Institute, an institute that really, you know, just kind of imparts knowledge and deals with big issues." God deliver us from the imbecile. Now, there's a fellow who's signed this, the petition, that is. His name is Michael Fuller. He's a Methodist also. He says he holds an undergraduate and MBA from SMU, and he sent his sons to SMU, and they hold undergraduate degrees. The youngest holds additional master's in math. I have SMU in our family trust and intend to leave money for the school for scholarships, but if the Board of Trustees goes through with this, I will change my mind. I cannot support this move to tarnish my school and its reputation by linking to this criminal. Mr. Fuller, I couldn't agree with you more. And Mr. Weaver, I'm delighted to have you on the show. Welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you. How are you?
I'm pleased. I'm doing fine this evening, Reverend Weaver. It's so kind of you to join us this evening. Of course,
it's
like
a pleasure.
Anything, it's a pleasure to have you here. Honestly, Reverend Weaver, I have talked about this issue on repeated occasions, and it seems to be heating up at this point. I have a Google set up to automatically forward articles to me that have the word Bush and library in the article. And over the past few months, there's been maybe one article a week, two article weeks, but suddenly there are 20, 30 articles. It seems to be reaching a boiling point. Reverend Weaver, could you give us your overview of this situation? Thank you, sir.
Well, Southern Methodist University is one of the 123 schools that Methodist Church built in this country. They very much came here. The Methodists came as kind of working-class Episcopalians initially, and a lot of their investment, as Catholics have, were with working people getting an education. Dukes of Methodist School, Emory, Syracuse, so forth. And it turns out Southern Methodist in Dallas is George Bush and his friends wish to put with the Presidential Library a partisan institute that the presses may value up to $500 million. And this is being organized and being money being raised by Karl Rove. What he is doing is setting up a sort of a heritage foundation and trying to put a cross on the front door under the guise that the Methodist Church somehow sanctions this. Much of this was done in secret, and the trustees themselves are the major culprits in this. Ray Hunt, who is one of the biggest both funders and benefactors of the George Bush war in Iraq. He's on the board of Halliburton and has his own oil company, and there's a whole list of people. In fact, 21 of the 40 trustees are large givers to George W. Bush. So they have been setting this up without people being aware of it from the beginning of his presidency, according to Ray Hunt, who was deposed and admitted that he had talked to the president shortly after he was sworn in the first term. So we have a real a challenge to the integrity and standards of the United Methodist Church. Torture is not a Methodist value. We may have a lot of faults, but we haven't yet gotten into torturing people and kidnapping them all over the world. And I think it's a profound moral issue. The partisan institute part of it, frankly, there that part of it undermines the academic integrity of the university. If there was a vote among the faculty, a secret vote, that there would be no retribution, I'm sure the majority of the faculty would vote against the Bartisan Institute. You know, in a university setting, you wouldn't want to have a Marxist-Leninist law school, and you wouldn't want to have a Hillary Rodham Clinton partisan institute. Partisan institutes are ideological places that are not designed for open academic study. So there are all sorts of problems with this, those are just a few of them.
Well, Reverend Weaver, you mentioned the friends that are involved on the Board of Trustees. Now, I have looked through that list, and it reads like a veritable who's who of business cronies, personal friends, people that attend parties, people who were called pioneers. If you recall Bush's fundraising, the pioneers raised $100,000, the Rangers raised $200,000. The Board of Trustees is filled with people like that, and I, too, understand that Rove, this has been planned since the year 2000, directly with the Board of Trustees, and I think as this is beginning to leak out now that it's becoming public, it's certainly causing an uproar in my mind anyway. I certainly can't imagine myself on paper anyway associated with any institution that would stoop low enough to lift up George W. Bush, and many of us feel that way. But the media, Reverend Weaver, is saying that this petition and the ability to stop this is sort of a last ditch effort. In other words, I think the media is trying to spin this as not having much hope. Can you tell us your thoughts on this and what we can do?
Well, there's a petition with 11,400 plus names. It is at www.protectsmu.org. There are 29 bishops in the United Methodist Church. That is no small thing, who signed this petition, saying it's utterly inappropriate that a Methodist institution be associated with George W. Bush. And some of the most prominent names in the United Methodist Church are on this list. So it is no small thing, and from every state in the union, and you see, one of the things is that it turns out that Southern Methodist University is the only large school we have which has the name Methodist on it. So this is going, Methodist is one of the most trusted brand names, if you could put it in that kind of term, in the world. It, you know, like Red Cross, it's highly trusted. And what George Bush is trying to do is rebrand himself. He wants to associate himself with people a name that people trust. What he's going to do, of course, to the church is rebrand us. And it has been appalling, actually. You know, he claims, George Bush and Dick Cheney, God help us, claim membership in the United Methodist Church. And there hasn't been enough calling this man to task within the church. The bishops in the United Methodist Church have repeatedly appealed to him to take their counsel on ending the war, and have made very strong statements from the very beginning about the war. He's ignored them. The people he will talk to are Jerry Falwell, when he was alive, and now John Dobson and the rest of them. George Bush has there is no history of him in the White House even attending the United Methodist Church, much less joining one. So it is, to a lot of us who are aware of our roots, the Methodist Church is a big tent church. You've got pretty conservative groups, but you've got basically a progressive, moderate group of people. And on most of the issues, they're pretty good about being heartful people. And the passion that is stated in that petition, and that one example that you read there of the alumni, I mean, most of these people are members of the United Methodist Church or the British Methodist Church or the Irish Methodist Church or the church in New Zealand, the church in Canada, United, I mean, they're two ex-presidents presidents of the Church, Methodist Church of New Zealand, who signed this. So there is a very deep feeling, and the short of it is that a vote comes in July of 290 delegates who were elected representatives of the 1.83 million people who live in that section of the United States, who is called the South Central Jurisdiction, who own the property. Southern Methodist University is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the United Methodist Church. In the same way, I assume that Notre Dame is owned, or Catholic University, by the Roman Catholic tradition. They cannot use the land unless they get a vote from that body. And I think you're right. Much of the press does not understand that the university is owned and has the last word in the use of the land. And I have spent the last several months talking, along with colleagues, to the delegates. And our calculation is there's 130-some people out of that 290 that are pretty progressive and liberal people. There's another 60 who are moderates, and there's about 100 who are conservatives. So the truth is that there is a real chance to get a vote, particularly against the partisan institute. That is simply unacceptable. We'll have no oversight. You know, literally, they can bring in the Scooter Libby, you know, distinguished chair of political ethics, and Wolfowitz, and the whole cast of characters, and try to rewrite history. That's what Roe will try to do. I think he'll have a hard time at it, but these guys, that's what this is about. And to put that on a campus of a church that has had some honor in things like challenging slavery in the abolitionist days, and the women's issues and other things of integrity, it's an outrage.
I completely agree that it's an outrage. I have a couple of questions about the workings, the internal workings. Apparently, it is the southern group of there's a listing of particular states. Texas is included, and I believe Oklahoma, Arkansas, Alabama. There's a group there. How is it that particular part of the country has control of the university when the university represents the entire church?
Well, that's a very interesting story. As it turns out, Vanderbilt in University in Tennessee was built by the Methodists. And at some point, the fathers of Nashville decided that they wanted to take it over. And for whatever reason, the legal documents weren't there. So when they built Emory in Atlanta, we're talking about beginning of the 20th century, SMU was founded in 1911. And SMU in Texas, they made sure that the ownership, they gave the ownership to those local jurisdictions. I honestly do not know the exact details. I know American University, for instance, is owned by the whole church, and exactly what the history was. Part of it, Peter, was that, you know, there was a split in the Methodists over the question of slavery. The Northern Methodist people said that we will not tolerate slavery, and so there was, until 1939, a split in the Methodist Church between the North and the South, so account for some of it. But the truth of the matter is that even in that section of the world, mainly because that seminary at SMU that I went to was a very progressive, enlightened seminary, has trained generations of clergy that are good leaders. And, you know, the Methodists are not a hard rock fundamentalist group. We're in a time where there is a lot of influence, and aggressive influence, from conservative religious elements in all of these churches, but they're not the majority. They're a minority, but they are often extremely well organized. The short version is that in terms of this decision, there is very much an opportunity to win it. And I think it would be a statement by the church of saying that, you know, we just do not countenance the kind of behavior George Bush lying us into a war of choice, squandering resources and the lives. I saw yesterday that there are now 29,092 wounded from the Iraq War alone. And you think about half of those people are maimed for life. And based upon what? Somebody's wanting to prove that he's what psychologically or a stronger personality than his father. I mean, it's been the most appalling demonstration of irresponsibility. And I frankly think that the President Bush and Dick Cheney have done more to harm the Christian religion's ability to have any integrity in what it's doing and its ability to be authentic than anyone since the Middle Ages. I'm not sure anybody's well done said. More damage than this since the Inquisition.
Well said. I couldn't agree with you more, Reverend Weaver. That's certainly well said. This gathering of the 260, I believe, is the total who will be able to vote on this.
Yep.
290. I'm told that let's call it the higher management, are trying to say that this is just a formality and that, in fact, their vote really doesn't matter because when the land was leased for the think tank and the Bush Library, that sealed the deal. And there's some controversy about whether the vote will count. Can you explain that to us, please?
Sure. Well, they haven't signed a lease yet. There's an interim committee that by a very highly lobbied and quite distorted process in terms of how it was done, had a 10-4 vote, and I was there that day. But this is an interim group. The final group, by the law of the church, are the 290 representatives on. So what they are elected from, there are, is Texas and New Mexico, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, Arkansas, and Louisiana. And as it turns out, say in Missouri and Nebraska and Kansas, the majority of the delegates on all of those delegations are pretty progressive people. In other words, you've got a real mixture of folks who've been very sympathetic. I mean, I talk to people, I don't have to explain it to them. They just say, absolutely, I'm going to vote against it. And what happened was that the George Bush Foundation went to the bishops in that area, and they said, we need your interpretation of what happened in that executive meeting and to say that, you know, we can sign a lease. Well, A, the bishops in the United Methodist Church, sorry, this gets down to technicalities, but short of it is, they don't have a right to do that in the Methodist Church. The Methodist Church, just like the federal government, has three branches. That the bishops are the executive, the jurisdictional council is the legislative, and then you've got a court. The only group that could possibly make a ruling that the bishops have asserted is the court, and that's by the laws of the Constitution of the United Methodist Church. But, you know, George Bush hasn't had any respect for the United States Constitution. Why in the world would he have any respect for the United Methodist Constitution? And so his people from his foundation put pressure on the bishops, you know, if you want this or whatever, and they let themselves be talked into it by the Bishop of Kansas. One man who is definitely gung-ho, he's on the trustees for this project, for his own, he is gung-ho for it. Well, and they were, I believe they're having second thoughts about it, because we began to get experts together in the church, scholars and others who have written them and said, by the way, guys, you can't do this. It's guys and gals, or two United Methodist bishop women in that group. But you can't do this. The law will not allow you to give those guarantees. So the truth is they're in a corner now. And the Bishop Scott Jones of Kansas has made, in these articles you're talking about, all sorts of assertions that the vote won't count, Even if it counts, the bishops can rule it down and gone so far as to say there won't be a vote. Well, I'll tell you, you start telling Americans after Florida and after Ohio that their vote won't count, that's the last thing I would tell them. And so people are upset across the country. And we got this list of 11,200 people, Peter, and we've sent out, and these bishops are getting a lot of emails saying, you know, what is it that you don't want people to vote? And so there needs to be all sorts of, you know, pressure put on them, because it undermines the fundamental integrity of our relationship, you know, as a people. If you, you need to have trust between people who work together in groups like churches, you know, that my rights, is going to be respect for me. And so the potential damage here is very significant. And I'm hoping, and there are signs that the bishops will back off this. And if they do that, then the foundation would almost be forced to go for the vote in July. And if that happens, in my estimation, we would have a very solid chance of winning. And I think that it would be shunning the President of the United States by saying, the United Methodist Church, this church you say you're a member of, we're saying this is not, we do not want to be a part of an institute that's going to promote your values and policies. And besides excommunicating from the church, that's about as strong a statement the church can make.
I completely agree, and it's a statement that so desperately needs to be made. There are a couple of questions coming from this room. One question is, one of the chatters is wondering if there are other groups or perhaps other denominations weighing in on this, or is it pretty much a private Methodist fight?
Well, in the petition, I would like anybody please sign it, because, I mean, whether you're, you know, a person of faith or no faith, or a person of conscience, any person of conscience is going to have questions given what this man has done. The stuff, Peter, that's going to spill out about the torture and kidnapping of innocent people, and God knows what, is going to spill out over the next years, and all of that stuff is going to be funneled towards this partisan institute to defend on a Methodist campus. So I would say to people, you know, please, you know, get people to sign the petition. The other part is that this tends to be, you know, I mean, anybody who wants to encourage other people to do the right thing and give a voice to it, please do. But it really is a matter, it comes down to, well, I mean, short answer is I'd love to have Episcopalians, Presbyterians, and Lutherans and the rest of these groups to make statements about it. What it has been so far is since, you know, it's like if Notre Dame was dealing with this. You know, the Catholics tend to focus on it because they own the university. But any help from people of conscience in any way is appreciated. And we have, the publicity we've gotten has really been remarkable, because we're just doing this as a group of people who are profoundly concerned. This country, I do not know, Peter, that in our lifetimes we can ever recover the sense of respect that the United States held in the world and the moral authority. I remember, you know, when the Buddhist monks marched in Thailand, a lot of those people were tortured to death, and God bless them, and murdered. And I thought to myself, how in the world can we declare to a dictator in across the world that they shouldn't treat these people with brutality when we do the same thing at Guantanamo? One of the signers of the petition, Peter, recently, a psychologist in Arkansas, I talked to her, and she said, I had a client from who worked at Gitmo, and he was so horrified by what he saw that he was required to sign a piece of paper to be able to get out of the place, saying he would never speak of what happened there forever. These people have hidden incredible atrocities, and it will come out simply because the it's just too powerful in people to want to tell the truth. But this man has acted in a way that is so separate from anything to do with fundamental teachings of Christ. It is not recognizable. There's a Christmas card, if I remember, that Cheney had. I don't know if you saw it in 2003 that he and Lynn Cheney sent out, and it said, "Surely, if God sees a sparrow fall, an empire cannot be built without his recognition of it."
I saw it. It was horrifying.
Now, you're talking about turning the gospel on its head.
Yeah.
You're getting into the world of, there's no other way to put it but evil. Because when you begin to, you know, the basis of real evil is lying to the point that, you know, people get completely confused. And you're dealing with people who the restraints that the great religions, Christianity and Judaism and Islam and the rest, is that do not be tempted to think that you can take on more power than you can handle and be humane. And these people have taken on the powers of God. They is calling that war shock and awe. That's the language of the divine, Peter. That's not human language. But it tells you exactly how they think in this world. And, I've got friends who think that this guy's going to bomb Iran before he leaves. And there's serious peace.
Yes, there's so, thoughts about that, too.
You know, any way in the world that we can lend voice to the fact that this man doesn't represent our ancestors and our good name, you know, anything we can do to challenge him, I think is our moral duty.
Well, Reverend Weaver, I completely agree with you, and I must say to you, sir, it's refreshing to hear a voice from the church saying the things that you're saying. We talk about these things on a regular basis, and in fact, the media, as it always represents the conservative, if we could call it that, point of view, and the right-wing spin machine, in the same way it only represents and carries the right-wing neocon voices of the so-called church, the voices that you're speaking of. And so many times the voices like your own are never heard, so people, it's done a huge amount of damage to Christianity as a whole. I don't know if the word
Absolutely.
Christian will ever recover from this. And I'm so glad also, Reverend Weaver, that you pointed out that others besides Methodists can sign this. I was not aware of that, and I'm glad to hear it. There is a new signer. One of our chatters has signed and also made the comment, "I was raised Roman Catholic, but I've always respected the Methodist Church for what it has contributed to our society. Please do not take part in this secular cover-up. Please do not lend your reputation to the worst administration in the history of this country, and please do not lend your name to the lies that will follow." And thank you, Lottie, for doing that.
Thank you.
There's another comment that's coming from chat to Reverend Weaver is to explore the Saudi money connection with you. The presidents don't have to talk about their funding for the library. I understand there was a bill introduced that would cause disclosure. I'm not sure where that got, probably nowhere. But it's our understanding here that there's a huge amount of oil money going from the Saudis to build this university, this think tank and library. Is that your input too?
Well, what we do know for sure is that his father, who has a policy institute at A&M, Texas A&M, and his library, there was funding from all sorts of sources in the Arab world. It's documented in a piece on mediatransparency.org. By my friend Bill Berkowitz, and there was money from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, from emirs, and this was millions upon millions of dollars. And one can only assume that it'll be the same. In fact, I thought when he went over there for this peace tour, so-called, that it may have been the place that he was trying to sell, you know, the idea. They'd set up this place and and, you know, completely have control over it. The university will have no say, and use the libraries and the facilities of the university. You'll never be able to tell one from the other. But I would say that the people who are going to fund it are foreign governments like George W. Bush's father. We don't know as it stands now. The other thing, Peter, that's outrageous is, has to do with the library. The first executive order George Bush signed right after 9/11 was an executive order saying that he can hold back any papers he wants, not only in his lifetime, but the lifetime of his heirs and his representatives in perpetuity. In other words, what you've got is not a library, but you have got George Bush saying what can be put in his propaganda center. And there was a bill that was passed when this was found out. Waxman started, but it was enough Republicans voted for it. It's veto-proof in the House to undo this because it was exactly the same request that, as it turns out, Richard Nixon wanted during the Watergate day. So, but what happened was it went over the Senate. Somebody, and they think it's Cochran of Texas or Bunning in Kentucky, the White House asked somebody to sit on the bill. And the archaic rules of the Senate are such you can just sit on it until you kill it. And it makes a mockery of the idea that it's even a library. I think, frankly, the library is just a ruse to get the partisan institute. Because they've demanded it, SMU take it like this, that tells me that. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm laughing with such joy. I'm just thrilled you're hitting every nail squarely on the head that we talk about on this network and all of the programs on this progressive radio network. And you're absolutely hitting everything squarely on the head. You're just amazing me. You really are.
Well, Peter, you know, what I say is the essence of shared biases or the essence of friendship. It sounds like you and I have shared biases.
Yes, I would agree.
Say that again.
I would agree. I was saying yes, I would agree. And there's another aspect of this I wanted to bring out too. Mark Tooley, who is with the IRD,
right,
and is also a CIA retired CIA agent, and the listeners have heard me go on about the Institute of Religion and Democracy in the past, that it is a partisan think tank, and it's charged with having the church carry out the needs of the government rather than to spread the word of Christ. Now, Mark Tooley has come out and said that the people who are opposing the library are just a bunch of Bush haters and liberals and,
right,
and you know, all the intellectuals. You know, all the words that they use. I think the word they hate us most with is intellectual. I think that really galls them. How would you characterize the IRD and its influence on the Methodist Church and with this whole situation?
Right. Well, Mark Tooley, it's interesting. He had a petition that they brought out, but they never disclosed after a year what numbers they got. I think they got pitifully few people to sign on, and it just got buried. I think they found out that that didn't work for them. Mark Tooley has made the argument that, you know, Carter has center there at Emory, which is another United Methodist school, and, you know, why are we jumping on poor George? The deal is that Emory, it actually isn't on campus, but Emory has a relationship with that center in which half of the trustees are appointed by the Emory University. In the SMU plan, this partisan think tank, there will be absolutely no control by anybody except George Bush's foundation and cronies. The other part of it is that that Carter's think tank is very much not trying to promote just what Carter believes, but trying to do good and to try to have open discussion. But the it also is under the kind of control that you would need to have a relationship with any kind of policy institute. And we went back and reviewed all of the presidential libraries. And there is nothing like this related to any presidential library. In fact, we don't believe there is such a partisan institute on any campus in the United States that we can find. This would be unique in the academia, and a beginning of something that is quite concerning, and that is the neocons beginning to try to take over academic institutions by putting a huge print a huge institute like this. You know, SMU has 11,000 students. It has a $1.1 billion endowment. This institute alone would, as they say, be $500 million. And my thinking is that is just lowballing it. I expect it'll be, $1 or $2 billion. I think that their plans are, with all the friends they've made wealthy off this war and the blood sacrifice of good people, they'll try to build something astronomical. And $500 million's bad enough. But the short of it is that there's nothing good about this in relationship to either SMU or the academy in general in this country.
Well, it certainly is dirtying the good name of
you
the United
to
Methodist.
You wanted to know about more about R.D. and Mr. Tooley. The Institute on Religion and Democracy has been around 26 years. It was formed out of the original Reagan right after he became president. Hard right wingers were upset that the liberation theology in Central America that was developing in El Salvador and Nicaragua was resisting Reagan's war plans in that part of the world, and that the Catholic Church primarily was aroused about it. So their original attack was really on liberation theology. Those people down there, they attacked people who were missionaries. They, accusing them of being Marxist, got people in a lot of danger and probably killed, according to the missionaries I talked to. They morphed when Reagan left the White House more into a singular attack on mainline Protestantism. They want to neutralize as much as possible, and possible, their ultimate goal is to take over the churches that represent about 25 to 30 million people in this country. That's United Methodist, the Presbyterians, Episcopalians, the Lutherans, United Church of Christ, who have, since the beginning of the Republic, been sort of the sensible core of religion in this country. And they've been pretty effective at it. They've gotten money from the outside. Richard Mellon Scaife gave the original seed money. The Bradley Foundation, the Olin Foundation, and a very strange man out in California called Amundsen, who, this guy has been a major funder for the Christian Reconstructionists that say that people like you and I who disagree with them ought to be stoned to death, and that gays and lesbians should be stoned to death. And that's the funders. So you can get an idea of the ideological twist in this. Their major attack is almost in the thing that they are able to move from fear-mongering to hate-mongering is on gays and lesbians. That is just an easy target, and they use it to create downright hate. There was an instance in the United Methodist Church a couple of years ago where they aroused so much hate that the Klan got involved. Mark Tooley is 42 years old. He obsesses over the sanctity of marriage, and he's never been married. And he's vitriolic. Now, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I can, I read this stuff, and emotionally for him, it is more than just a left-brain analytic issue. You're talking about the kind of language that comes from some deep emotional place. I've never done the psychological testing or interviews necessary, but whatever that conflict is, it's something that really churns him. And so Tooley, an ex-CIA agent, has used his propaganda skills to lie, twist, and distort. And basically that he and the center of this is a true scandal actually isn't even Thule. The true scandal is the people behind this thing who've been connection, Peter, to the big money are Roman Catholics. Richard Newhouse, David Novak, and a guy named Weigel are three prominent Roman Catholics who had been the means by which they could get money. Now, most Roman Catholics have no idea who these people are or what in the world they believe. There's a book out there called Theocons, Peter, by David Linker. He's the editor of a magazine called The First Things that Newhouse has. And he writes an incredible book about the danger of these people. And they have been ensconced in the Bush White House. Bush himself calls Richard Newhouse Father Richard and refers to him as a key advisor in religious matters, i.e. abortion, stem cell, sexuality, and so forth. So it's a million-dollar institute that just constantly beats up on anybody in the church who says anything that's progressive at all. I asked one time Martin Marty, a great historian in Chicago, did he know of any example in church in the history of this country where outside money built an attack using people from other religious traditions? There are also four Jewish brothers and sisters on the advisory committee, all of them neocons. Medved, the guy on the radio, is one of them. And 100% of their money, including their tax documents, Peter, say that they're spending it all to renew Protestant churches. So the thing is ludicrous on the face of it, but they're pretty good at it. You know, the old adage that if you lie long and big enough, somebody's going to believe you. And when you charge it with things like human sexuality, you know, you charge people up. Gay and lesbian folks have been the scapegoat of the right wing, as they were under Nazism. Any difference about sexuality, Christianity doesn't know what to do with it, and human beings in general get rattled. So there's a bit of a plot.
Well, my understanding of the irony also is that this attempt to, quote, renew various denominations, that the people who are individually charged with certain denominations, for instance, I think there's a whole group there that's dedicated to monitoring, quote, the Methodist Church and the statements that are made and to make things divisive, that many of these people are not even Methodists or the other people who monitor.
Right.
They're attempting to renew a church they're not even part of, but renew is such a wrong word. It's not even close to renewal.
Well, it is part of how, of course, the neocons have been brilliant at trying to reframe their arguments in ways. I mean, it's like leave no child behind, leave all the children behind. I mean, it is, you know, George Lakoff, you know, the guy that wrote that fabulous little book called Don't Think of the Elephant in the Room at Berkeley. I mean, he talks about exactly. I mean, what they want to do is ruin these churches. They don't want to renew them. I mean, when the head of the operation there, a guy who is in a schismatic Presbyterian church, in that church, they don't believe in women's ordination. Now, we have almost one in four women in the United Methodist Church who are ordained among our clergy. Does that mean they're going to renew us by taking a fourth of all the clergy out? I mean, the thing's preposterous. And it is simply it is something, of course, the church hasn't known exactly how to handle it, because this kind of calculated scheming and organizing that is connected to the hard right wing has been, unfortunately, United Methodist and most of these folks, Presbyterians and the rest, suffer from acute naivete about these things. You know, there is still a tendency for people, liberals particularly, to think, well, they're just, you know, if we're nice enough to them, they'll be reasonable. They ain't going to be reasonable. And people, go ahead.
Now, I was just thinking about the IRD. My understanding, too, is that the board, the people who run the IRD, are self-perpetuating in the sense that they're not really answerable to any church or any faith organization. They are simply there to keep the Institute running. So my feeling is that they have a huge interest, a huge stake in having the think tank there at the Southern Methodist University, because they will no doubt gain from that. And perhaps it seems to me they have a vested interest, is all I'm saying.
Well, I think anything's possible, because if you've got Roe running the operation and you've got unlimited resources and no oversight, well, look at this administration. I mean, anything's possible. And the worst imaginable is possible. That is why it is sheer folly to begin to allow something like this on any academic campus, much less one attached to a church that has a history in some ways of a strong social conscience. And it's as people become aware of it, you know, the arguments are so strong on our side. People think, well, you know, a library, even if he's a bad guy, some people argue. But when you start talking about promotion of his policies and values, the people say, no way. So, but the IRD is the Institute on Religion and Democracy has done, you know, the big fault, honestly, is that people who are moderates and progressives in the church need to awaken and have more courage to speak up. You know, there are moral obligations to having faith. It's not just going and, you know, feeling nice about yourself and getting dressed up. If you don't stand for something, you know, the other side will just win because the moderates and the liberals are too quiet. And one of the things that I think this issue about SMU is a way to somehow get a focus on an issue that is a matter of profound conscience. For me, the bottom line is this man has done so many things that have been really crimes against humanity. It's just, you know, if the church stands for anything, it's got to stand against things like torture and kidnapping, international kidnapping of, and now we're told that not up to 90% of the people that they have pulled into Guantanamo and God only knows where, we don't know, are completely innocent.
Yes. And one statement I came across today regarding the IRD is that they are, one way they're twisting the truth is to say that the that mainstream churches, that there's a decline in membership, and it's the fault of the liberals and the progressives who have turned the church towards social action, and the IRD is needed to repair the damage. It's
right.
Almost as if they create the damage. And then the article goes on to say that scientific evidence shows that the decline in membership in mainline churches is simply the result that the conservative churches, they have more children, basically.
Yes.
I was shocked to read that, because their arguments are so convincing to people who don't understand and don't read things like this. That's so divisive.
Well, that's an extremely good point, Peter, and not many people realize that. And it was a study. Andrew Greenlee was one of them. He was a really big sociologist of religion a few years ago, and they looked at all the demographic data for 70 years and tried to figure out, you know, in equations and math, which can be done, just what were the reasons why these churches were in decline. Well, almost all of the decline was accountable by one fact, and that is in mainline churches, the women tended to get more educated, married later, and had fewer children. Literally, it was not replacing the kids. Now, as in the variable of, even to this day, if you're born in a Pentecostal or Southern Baptist church, you're might more likely to end up a Presbyterian or a Methodist or an Episcopalian than the other way around, because it's a function of education. But they blame the victim. What I would say is that they've been a primary reason, if there's any other, of the church's decline, because what we do know is high amounts of conflicts in churches is the strongest single variable for a church not to grow. And so they're completely stirring up the pot is blaming the victim. And it's like the logic of blaming gays and lesbians for the divorce rate in the United States. Divorce rate is that way because the lack of mature relationships between straight folks has nothing to do with gays and lesbians. I mean, it's apples and oranges. And I don't know if they're confused by the comparison, but the short of it is that, yeah, they say that, you know, it has to do with social, there is no, the variable is that as women get married later, they have fewer children, and this same development happens, Peter, in the Pentecostal and Southern Baptist churches over time. As their people get more educated, you see the same demographic. And exactly. Very few people know that. I appreciate you bringing it up, because I pointed this out to IRD repeatedly, but they have no interest in the facts. And the only thing they believe in is, ideology. What drives people to have that kind of malice against people just trying to do good? I mean, the Methodist Church, along with these other mainline churches, give tens of millions of dollars a year to incredibly worthy causes. Against malaria in Africa, against HIV worldwide. Just perfectly decent things like helping children who don't have parents. I mean, and to do that, it stinks in the nostrils of God. You know, I agree with Woody Allen. If Jesus came back to see what these people were doing in his name, he couldn't stop throwing up.
Wow. Yeah, I've got to say, Reverend Weaver, you have been a very, very powerful and much-needed voice that we have heard tonight. And I should point out, we've been posting the link to the petition in the chat room, but for those of you who are not in chat, it's at www.protectsmu, that's Southern Methodist University, protectsmu.org, and you can find information there about the about what Reverend Weaver is doing. And I just can't thank you enough for coming on and explaining things to us. This is far better than I was ever able to do. You have been on the inside trenches. That's fairly clear.
Well, it's very kind of you, and it's been a pleasure indeed. And you're a very generous, kind person, and John Wesley said to his preachers, do all the good you can, do as little ill as possible, and live by the commandments of God. And I think that's a very straightforward thing, and it's quite a pleasure indeed to be able to get to know you, and I wish you well in all your endeavors.
Thank you, Reverend Weaver, and I must tell you that the chat room is overwhelmed by you. I can't begin to tell you the wonderful comments I've seen scroll by, including comments saying that they would like you to come back. And I have to agree that we would like to have you again on the show if you would be willing.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. And I've written a bunch of books on different clinical subjects and the role of religion in mental health and all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, I'd be more than happy to. It'd be a pleasure.
Wonderful.
Thank you again.
Wonderful. I can't thank you enough. And you've just been a remarkable guest.
Well, I thank you, sir, and peace be with you.
Thank you, Reverend Weaver. Peace be with you also. And my friends, that was Reverend Andrew Weaver. He is a PhD and a minister in the United Methodist Church, and it is about time that that we heard a voice with that depth and that strength saying the things that Reverend Weaver needed to say. And I'm deeply indebted to him for coming on the show and doing that for us. So the world gets scarier and scarier, does it not? Every time we turn around, we find out about a new think tank who has its fingers in their rank and file and is attempting to control us by dividing us and is doing a damn fine job, I might point out. And, wow, how do you follow a guest like that? I tell you what we're going to do. We are going to run, go to a break. We're actually going to go into break with a wonderful track that our the world's most dangerous and lovable DJ has sent in for us to enjoy this evening. We'll go to break with that, and we'll follow it up with a break. This is Winona Judd. I Want to Know What Love Is.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Tune in to Foxed Up this Thursday midnight Eastern, where we'll take a look at singer Sheryl Crow. Find out about her experience working for Michael Jackson.
Michael is you know, he's not like every other performer, and I think everyone has to sign a contract when they work with him, not to write a book, you know, about what goes on behind the scenes or whatever.
She'll also talk about her problems with Walmart. So be there this Thursday midnight Eastern on Foxed Up, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
All I want to do is have a little fun before I die. There's a man next to me out of nowhere.
This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
And he's back, riding across America on a horse called Strictly Confidential. It is I, Peter Godbold. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Welcome to Hour 2 of Strictly Confidential. I could not be happier to be with you this evening, and I'm so pleased that you are indeed with me. Some wonderful things are happening on Strictly Confidential. We're adding no less than two. Yes, read that, two new DJs to our rotation for God's Little Gay Bar across the street, which Bob so appropriately named. Thank you, Bob. And we will be having a new DJs, two new DJs, I believe. We'll start in the rotation next week. We will have a DJ from Miami and also a new DJ from Seattle. And we will have both those DJs actually as guests on the show in the fairly near future, but they're going to be joining our rotation. It's a veritable who's who in the world of Hall of Fame DJs. We could not be more blessed with the DJs or the guests. What a wonderful job this is. I'm so happy. What a wonderful job this is. I'm just amazed that I am here. Let's see, what story can I start the top of the hour with? Oh, yes, our DJ for the God's Little Gay Bar across the street, which will start sometime near the bottom of the hour, I would think about 10:35, will be the fabulous D.C. LaRue. And we will be running his segment about 10:35, and we're going to run his Cathedral Suite. And DC was actually a guest on this show. If you'd like to go back and hear that remarkable interview, that was on November 21st. So you would go to strictlyconfidentialradio.com and click on the November calendar, and you will pull up the 21st of November, and you can listen to the legendary DC LaRue. Amazing story here. I'm looking at a piece of paper that has just about the most lovable little puppy on it I have ever seen, a little floppy-eared brown puppy with a perfect little black nose and little brown eyes that are staring up. He has a white chest, and he's a brown. Most of him is brown, except he has one white foot, a precious little doggy. And then we find that lesbians cannot be prevented from purchasing puppies in Sweden, according to an appeals court. Lord help us. The court confirmed an earlier district court ruling in favor of a lesbian who had sought damages from a kennel owner who refused to sell her a puppy because of her sexual preference. The kennel owner must now pay the woman $3,000 in damages for subjecting her to discrimination and harassment. The incident began when the woman called a kennel, it's based in Stockholm, to inquire about an advertisement for a puppy, this beautiful little puppy I'm looking at. The woman told the kennel owner, who was also a woman, that she liked animals and that she and her partner would have plenty of time to take care of the little doggy since they were both students. But when the kennel owner learned that the woman's partner was also a woman, she put a stop to the sale. And in the kennel owner's explanation, she says that she denied the woman the puppy, and the kennel owner made references to earlier contacts she had with transvestite couples, saying that she had read that transvestites are connected to, hope you're sitting down for this, animal pornography. How do you do that? This is a totally new concept for moi, and I thought I had heard it all. Yes, you pesky transvestites are connected somehow to animal pornography. God help us. The kennel owner made it clear that she would not be allowed to buy the puppy, the woman who was attempting to buy it, that she would not be allowed to buy that puppy because she did not, quote, trust homosexuals. I went to a court. There's a description of the court, discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. Both the district court and the appeals court rulings were unanimous, and the kennel indeed had to sell her the puppy and pay her damages of $3,000. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. Because she had read that transvestites are connected to animal pornography. I have another story in here that's sort of related to these just unbelievable stories that people hear and that they believe. Here it is. It's from the You Think Left blog. There's a link, by the way, at strictlyconfidentialradio.com to the You Think Left site. And our dear friend Cassie, who is also known as Freckles, a.k.a. Freckles, runs that site, the You Think Left blog. Now, Freckles is a young lady, and she's a teenager. I don't exactly know how old, but she stops in chat from time to time. She's a delightful person, and one of our favorite up-and-coming progressives. In Cassie's blog, she tells us that today in her social studies class, they had a debate over the Supreme Court case, Wade versus Boy Scouts of America. I'm all said Alabama. Oh, God, I'm always on some sort of tirade about Alabama or Arkansas. God forgive me for beating up. I'm just... the Boy Scouts of America. So in the case, you see, a man had been a Boy Scout for 12 years, and he earned the coveted rank of Eagle Scout. And he began telling people that he was gay. And because of that, he was kicked out of the Scouts. And he then took them to court because they had violated his rights. Many of you have heard this story. But they got away with it because they were a private business, the Boy Scouts of America, private business. And it said it was against the business, said it was against their morals and values that they're trying to instill in boys in the program. So during the debate, you see, the teacher asked which side the class thought should win. The vote was 32-2. Against the gay man. Just another example of what's going down, what's going on, brother. This shows that even though people say that children these days look past sexual preference and gender and race and ethnicity, it's still not equal. And, of course, the right-wing drum beaters are doing their job because during the debate, many of the children took the grounds that the gay man would sexually assault the children. Cassie goes on to say she just doesn't think that a lot of people get it, the difference between LGBT folks and pedophiles. Just because someone likes someone of the same sex does not mean they're rapists. Cassie goes on to say that even though I'm straight, I still do not want to rape. And she sees the differences there. So, in fact, she points out, too, that in the news, more kids are sexually assaulted by married preachers and members of the church than LGBT persons. So anyway, that puppy story reminded me, because the puppy lady had read that transvestites, Jesus, is so warped, even my demented little mind can't wrap around. Transvestites are connected to animal pornography. You pesky transvestites, you got to cut that stuff out. You just got to stop. Huge benefits if you work for Goldman Sachs these days, by the way. Bankers at Goldman Sachs normally get huge bonuses every year, and in fact, they even have great job security there because Goldman Sachs was able to steer clear of the worst of the subprime mortgage meltdown. So we can add another reason to the list of why life is great at Goldman Sachs: free sex change surgery. Yes, you heard it first here at Strictly Confidential. Fortune.com has reported Friday that Goldman added coverage of sex reassignment surgery to its medical plan last year. The article is part of a sidebar on, quote, unusual perks. Well, glory, that is an unusual perk that came with Fortune's last ranking of the 100 best companies to work for in the United States. Now, Goldman was up to number 9, which is significantly higher than the number 36 last year. Goldman employees can undergo the procedure, a sex change. Which normally costs between $5,000 to $150,000 and have it paid for entirely, 100% no deductible, by their medical insurance. Pretty amazing, huh? Can't believe I live to see the day. Mrs. Goldman isn't the first financial firm to cover sex change surgeries for its workers. A recent survey of more than 1,000 employers conducted by the HRC found that many banks and law firms and large companies have at least partial coverage of transgender treatments in their medical plans. Now, Bank of America, whom I happen to bank with, and Wachovia, who I happen to used to bank with, and Deutsche Bank, that's not Deutsche Bank, it's Deutsche Bank, which I have never dealt with, apparently. It's much too highfalutin for me, are also firms who cover such treatment to some extent. Goldman said the Bank of America covers the cost of the actual operation. Now, Wachovia, it's considered elective, so the operation isn't covered, but your prescriptions and post-operative counseling are covered. And goes on to describe some of the other companies. Isn't that amazing what's going on in the world? Yet the IRD is still tearing the churches apart. And it's all about control, is it not? Interesting article I came across over at the Blairico Project, our friends over at Blairico. By the way, we're talking with Blairico about developing an audio segment that will run on the Head On Radio Network that will be done by the Blairico Project, which is a wildly popular LGBT news blog. And so we're looking forward to that. They will have a short segment on the show to talk about Blairico, and it sounds like fun. It's fun partnering with the LGBT community. Have I mentioned lately that I love my job? If I haven't, I love my job. In any case, Jeremy, who is Bill's partner, is writing an article about taxes. And, of course, Jeremy is a computer guy. He's the computer brains that keeps the Blairico Project running and keeps all the appearance of the blog and all the links happy and what have you. He's a technology kind of guy. He's talking about taxes, and he understands that they are a necessary evil and that they keep democracy running smoothly. And the funding keeps the democracy able to handle everything that life throws at a civil society, or what's left of it anyway. And points out that knowing this doesn't really make it easier when you see the withholding numbers on your check stub or have to cut a check on April 15th. So he's writing that yesterday, and this is dated the 12th, so I think this has been the 11th, he was reading an article in a computer journal comparing the major tax preparation packages. Of course, the two big ones are TurboTax and Tax Cut, its competitor. Those are the two big ones. Now, those are both boxed software suites. Now, you can pick them up at where anywhere from Walmart to Best Buy to you name it, although because of the way Walmart treats workers, we don't really recommend you pick up your copy of TurboTax or Tax Cut right there. In any case, these are not online services. There are online tax services where you go to the website and you put in all your information on their various screens and it calculates for you. This is software that you buy and you own it. And there was an article in the reviews that was talking about the various programs, and he said there was a particular section to the article, the reviews, that caused him to raise an eyebrow, and he writes, then this is a quote from the article from the fellow who's reviewing the software, "But from my vantage point, many taxpayers would be wise to seek out a well-trained pro. That list begins with registered domestic partners who must now file as married couples on their state returns, even though the federal government does not recognize such unions." Now, this particular article was targeted toward a California audience, so it's fairly clear why they're bringing up a domestic partnership. And, of course, this brings up the whole idea of domestic partnerships and things that you have to deal with. It's something that civil unions and domestic partnerships are facing all across the country, and Jeremy is asking, can you imagine what a nightmare it must be for California domestic partners to file taxes every year? There is absolutely no software package available that handles your situation, period. None. Nada. The options are very, very limited. Either you dust off your adding machine and try to figure it out yourself with your pencil and paper, or you hire someone to do it for you so you don't screw it up. Now, this is... even though California's domestic partnerships laws are open to same-sex and opposite-sex couples, Jeremy is venturing that he is pretty sure that the majority of folks registering are same-sex couples. So here again, Jeremy points out that we are putting an undue burden upon LGBT families. And he says that even when the system tries, it, shall we say, messes up. And he goes on to point out that that's exactly what Separate But Equal does every time. I could not agree with him more. That is exactly what it does every time. Points out, too, that California is the home of Silicon Valley. Some of the greatest technologies companies in the world are located there. I'm sure any one of us could rattle off a few of them. But you can't use modern technology to file your taxes if you are a registered domestic partner. Tax prep software has to be updated every year, of course, to keep up with the tax code changes. But the software companies just don't seem to care about the growing number of taxpayers that they simply cannot market to. I wonder, you know, it just puzzles me that TurboTax, the new LGBT version, LGBT version 3.2, TurboTax. You know, it's just a hoot to me to even consider separate tax packages. Oh, my stars. What is the world doing to us? Anyway, Jerry points out that he hasn't actually looked it up, but he's wondering if it's a problem elsewhere, that if there are other domestic partnerships and civil union laws in the country or is California the only state that requires couples? You see, California requires couples to file as married if they are in a domestic partnership. He's wondering if other states are requiring that too. And, of course, the federal government does not acknowledge it whatsoever. And Jeremy goes on to point out that this is why we cannot accept anything less than full marriage equality. I completely agree with you, Jeremy, and not because you're just another computer geek like me. I just agree with you, Larry. I'm sorry, Jeremy. And he points out, too, that partnerships and civil unions will never work in the end. I completely agree. He says that California has had to amend their domestic partnership law something like 11 times, many of which were simply to clarify what in the heck a domestic partnership was. If you remember a while back, well, by the way, we just changed to a different subject. I know you're used to paper here, Russell Paper. Okay. Now you know I've just changed to a different article. Okay. Remember we did the whole story about the faith healers? Oh, what a sordid little story that was. We played the audio. It sounded like Satan in a box. Just awful, awful stuff. If any of you heard that show, I still have bad dreams about some of the stuff we heard on that particular show. I don't remember when that was. It was a while back. It was a Just Us show. Sometimes the Just Us shows get really badly out of control. In any case, a former senior accountant at Oral Roberts University. This is the university we started with that led us down the road to the various faith healers, which were, of course, pocketing as much money as they could possibly pocket. In fact, one of the faith healers got the last $5 a little old lady had, and backstage boasted that he got her last $5. He just can't imagine the corruption that goes on there. But in any case, a former senior accountant at Oral Roberts University alleges that more than $1 billion annually was inappropriately funneled through the school. He claims in a lawsuit that he filed that he discovered an unrestricted account used to funnel unusually large sums of money through the university each month that would exceed $1 billion, that's with a B, dollars on an annual basis. This is money, of course, from the little blue-haired ladies that send in their Social Security checks and some of the little blue-haired men. He also goes on to point out that it wasn't serving any legitimate purpose at the university. And, of course, the university spokesman is saying this has no basis in fact. And he said that this is grounded in fantasy. But you see, Huddleston is the man who's bringing this forward. He was hired in 2006. He spent 15 months at the school, and he was discharged because the school officials feared he would reveal that the account even existed. And he named his defendants are Richard Roberts, who is Oral Roberts' son, if I'm not mistaken, and the school's former president, and his wife Lindsay, who, if you recall our story previous to this, has a thing for the young college kids that go to the Oral Roberts University. And the initial complaint alleged that Huddleston was actually ordered by Richard Roberts and Lindsay Roberts, the wife and the hubby, to, quote, cook the books by hiding improper illegal financial wrongdoings from public authorities and to defraud the IRS. And Roberts resigned as the president actually the day after Huddleston filed the lawsuit. Imagine that. And the new trustee board is, quote, committed to resolving the outstanding litigation, et cetera, et cetera. Now, why am I bringing this up on an LGBT radio show? Well, one little thing here. The university, created by televangelist Oral Roberts, will not enroll openly gay students, and students that are already enrolled, if they're found to be gay, can be expelled. All students are required to sign an honor code saying that, and I quote, I will not engage in or attempt to engage in any illicit, unscriptural sexual... I'm sorry, but this is a whole new concept to me. Unscriptural sexual acts? Oh, my stars. If I recall, I've read some pretty... Well, let's not go there. But you have to be pretty far out there to be unscriptural. And these shall include any homosexual activity. You shall not even attempt it. I suppose that's if you're incompetent and you're just learning to be a homosexual, you might attempt it and get it wrong. And, of course, if you'll recall our dear friends from Soul Force, who have been guests on this show on a couple of occasions previously, they've talked about the Soul Force Equality Riders, who are young folks, and they travel around in a huge bus. They go to various campuses and attempt to meet with the upper crust and talk about the way these campuses treat the LGBT folks. Soul Force actually went to Oral Roberts University, and there was a warning not to enter the campus, several dozen of them. This was on a 51-day cross-country trip, and their buses arrived, and the riders were on the street, and they were arrested. And, the university would not even let them set foot on the grass. And again, it repeats the honor code, unscriptural sexual acts. Amazing. So one by one, the members of Soul Force crossed the street, and as they reached the gate, they were warned by the Oral Roberts University and then arrested. So anyway, that's why I'm bringing up the Oral Roberts University, sort of a tangent to all the things we've talked about this evening. We are getting very close to the time we need to pick up our little umbrellas and find our hats and coats, and we're going to wander across the street to the gay bar across the street that Bob has named God's Little Gay Bar. And Bob, I just think that's priceless. Oh yeah, that's, you know, it would be divine justice for me to end up with a little dance club called God's Gay Bar. It would be just priceless. But in any case, our DJ this evening at the gay bar across the street, God's Little Gay Bar, is Mr. D.C. LaRue. And as I told you earlier, D.C. was on the show in November. That was November 21st. And it was a wonderful interview. If you'd like to go back and hear that at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. And so as we open the doors and venture into the little gay bar across the street, we find that D.C. LaRue is already at the table. Roll it, Bob. And there we have the legendary, and I do mean legendary, D.C. LaRue, playing at God's Little Gay Bar across the street. You can find out more about D.C. LaRue at dclarue.org. That's www.dc, and LaRue is spelled L-A-R-U-E. That's dclarue.org. And so glad that he could join us in our legendary DJ set, which we call the Gay Bar Across the Street. Tomorrow night, we're going to have a music guest, so there will be no Gay Bar Across the Street segment. Our music guest tomorrow evening is Mr. Scott Free, who you're going to find to be just amazing. Scott's music is very different than what we normally run the show, and in fact, I'm at a loss to describe it to you. Just some amazing stuff. If you remember, we brought Scott Free up when we did the segment regarding LGBT performers not being paid to play at LGBT pride events, and that they were asked to work for free. But the mainline acts were all paid. We talked about a number of artists who were treated in that way. And in fact, Scott originally came up during that conversation because he started an organization or a group to make some noise about that, and I'm very glad that he did. And that will be a remarkable interview. We've got lots of music from Scott Free tomorrow night. I'm going to be digitizing that and sending it up to the studio, and we will have a full 2 hours of amazing conversation and songs and tracks that are original that you're just not going to believe. And also want to let you know that coming up on February the 14th, which is Thursday, I believe, we will have DJ Bobby Vittoretti at the Gay Bar Across the Street. And February 15th, we'll have DJ Jerry Bonham from the Trocadero series, the Trocadero 30th anniversary. And that was from just last year, 2007. And then starting again next week, we'll come up with a new schedule. We'll have Larry Sanders. We'll have Hank from, he's a DJ in Miami. We'll tell you more about Hank when the time comes and have him as a guest in the show. We'll have a new DJ from Seattle. We'll be having back our dear friend VJC, who says hello like nobody on the planet. You gotta love that guy. And no doubt I'm leaving some people out because I don't have the list in front of me, but it is a very long list, and those are just the ones that I happen to cross my mind right now. But that will be for the rest of the week. And let's see, 10:55. Want to get this in. I've been meaning to tell you this story since January the 23rd. You know, normally we don't do sleaze market tabloid stuff here, but, you know, if it involves Rush Limbaugh, I'm not too proud. Rush Limbaugh has a new bimbette. Yes, in fact, he does. He's got a new squeeze. She is blonde and blue-eyed and half his age. Is anyone surprised? She is a professional golf hoe. She worked for Gary Player in various tournaments, and her capacity was not listed. She's also, at this point in time, her job is VIP of relations for South Florida's Super Bowl host committee, and her job involves showing visiting NFL owners a good time. So now she's an NFL hoe, and Rush has proudly escorted her down the red carpet aisle in a paparazzi event at Miami's Miami Beach Ritz-Carlton. The occasion was a high-profile lawyer, Roy Black. It was a charity benefit. Now, if you'll recall, Roy Black, and Black was representing billionaire sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And he also helped Rush get out of the 2003 bind when he went down to, the Dominican Republic to molest little boys. And with his bottles of Viagra, there is really no reason to fly to the Dominican Republic with bottles of Viagra. It is known, wasn't it the Dominican Republic? Am I getting that right? It is well known for its trade in exploiting children. And poor Rush got caught with bottles of Viagra, and he was able to get by, I think, with the painkillers that time. But anyway, he's got himself a new blonde, blue-eyed squeeze, who is, whose resume includes being a golf hoe and an NFL hoe. You just can't top that. I'm so pleased to tell you that we do have a horn section this evening. It will be myself and the fabulous John Fox from Australia. Perhaps we'll get to hear from Skippy tonight. I've always wanted to hear Skippy. I know John has a little Skippy kangaroo down there locked up in a little wicker crate or something or another. And we'll also have the famous and could not do without him radio host Bob Kincaid with us this evening. And, of course, that will be followed by John Fox live show, which will start at midnight Eastern time, all foxed up. And the horn section, which is unscripted host banter, will start in just a few minutes at 11 p.m. Eastern time. It's been a wonderful show, thanks to the guests. I have enjoyed being here, and have I mentioned lately that I love my job? Here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.